Well, it's good to be with you again. Shall we just pray? Lord, we bow before you as we've come once again to think about your creation. We come before you knowing that we know nothing. We're thankful that you've given us your word and that your word is the only thing we can rely on. We pray that you'll help us today, that you'll open our eyes, that you will lead and guide into your truth. Amen. Well, how old is the earth? The only thing we can rely on is the Bible. And the Bible gives us an idea of how old the earth is. There are some people who are convinced the Bible gives us an exact age for the earth, and they've worked it out to the very day. I personally don't believe the Bible is written in such a way that we can work it out to the day or even to the year. But the wisdom of man has come to the conclusion that the earth is about 4,500,000 years. And that is what is published in all the respectable journals. It's what everyone's taught at school and university. But there's a very great deal of evidence that tends to agree with what the Bible says and disagree with this enormous figure of 4.5 billion years. For example, the Earth has an atmosphere. It's got several gases in it. One of those gases is helium. Now, helium is constantly being added to the atmosphere by radioactive decay processes. The rocks of the Earth have radioactive material which is decaying and producing helium. And that helium ends up in the atmosphere. There is not enough to account for the age of millions of years. In fact, there is enough helium in the atmosphere to account for about 10,000 years. This is a problem known in science as the problem of the missing helium. There's enough to account for an age of about 10,000 years, and all the rest is missing. Then there's the problem of the Earth's magnetic field. The Earth's magnetic field is not there because the Earth is a magnet. The Earth on the inside is too hot to be a magnet. The reason the Earth has a magnetic field is because there are electric currents circulating. And those currents produce a magnetic field. It's a well-known principle of physics called induction, and that is very well known as a phenomenon in physics. We can describe it very accurately. And as the current circulates, it produces a magnetic field. But there is resistance in the iron core of the Earth, which tends to slow down the current, decays away, and as the magnetic field decays away, that tends to keep the current going. The decay of the field induces the current to try and maintain the field, but it's decaying away, and all the equations show it's decaying away exponentially. The observations show it's decaying away exponentially, and it has a half-life of about 1,400 years. That means every 1,400 years it becomes half as strong. This is the fastest observed geophysical phenomenon, the decay of the Earth's magnetic field. It's been calculated that in 2,000 years, a compass needle will no longer point north. The field would have faded away so much. But pushing back in the past, 1,400 years ago, it was twice as strong as it is today. 2,800, it was four times as strong. Now, if you go back in the past, there are some interesting landmarks you come to. If you get to about 20,000 years, it would have been so hot that nothing could have survived on the Earth. If you go back much before that, the whole Earth would melt from the heat. One that's very interesting for me, if you push it back beyond about 6,000 BC, the current, the field is so strong that bees can no longer work. So if we look at this decaying more than 6,000 years, if bees can't work, what pollinates the plants? Another point, if we look forward, it's not very far from now where the field is too weak for bees to work. They fly by magnetic compass. So if we go very far in the future, what is going to pollinate the crops? But the magnetic field certainly is not compatible with more than just a few thousand years. Another thing, the Earth is constantly receiving material from space. You can often see meteorite showers. There was one only about a month ago. And besides the meteor showers that we can see, which are materials of say, about this big, we're constantly getting a shower of tiny dust particles that you never even see, because they slow down so quickly in the atmosphere, they never glow, they never become shooting stars. And this material is constantly falling upon the Earth. And it's distinctive because it's very high in a nickel, a material called nickel. The rainfall washes it into the rivers. The rivers flow into the seas. We can measure how much is in the rivers. We can measure how much is in the seas. There is enough to account for this process going on for just over 10,000 years. Now, the story that we all know from school, from university, that story comes in with millions of years. Now, we've had a look at this story and seen that it is all 100% based on a speculation called the uniformity principle. But now most people are under the impression that those ages here, all these millions of years, actually come from radiometric dating. It's not true. Now, radiometric dating is based on the fact that there are certain materials, like uranium, which gradually decay through a whole lot of steps down to lead. Or some other kind of decay, but uranium to lead is a particularly good one. Now, what you do to analyze this and set up the radiometric dating is you take a piece of uranium and you put it inside a big, thick lead shield. And then you observe what happens to that uranium for a few months. And then you say, if the processes going on here are all that ever happened to lead, uranium, it breaks down into lead. And it breaks down to lead at a certain rate. So you can say, if we find so much lead next to so much uranium, then we can work out how long it took the uranium to decay away to that much lead. But it assumes that nothing is ever going to happen to uranium except what happens inside that big, thick lead shield. It assumes that the rate at which it decayed in the few months that we observed it also happened, everything at the same rate, way back as far as we can look in the past. And it assumes that if we find lead next to uranium, there wasn't any there to start with. There's been no other method of making uranium or lead, and that nothing has moved in or out. There are a lot of assumptions. And how do we start off this process? Well, we have to start off with some pure uranium. How do we find pure uranium? Well, we assume that if there's a volcano, the movement of the lava will be so vigorous that any lead will be separated from uranium, and when the rock sets, there we've got some uranium that was by itself. Now we've got a whole lot of assumptions, and of course it means the only rock we can date is volcanic rock. You cannot date a fossil by radiometric means. You cannot date most of the rocks that you come across by radiometric means because they're not volcanic. The only thing you can date is volcanic rocks, and they all rely on the assumptions you've made. Now, Henry Fall, an expert on this, said uranium and lead both migrate in geological time, and detailed analyses have shown that useful ages cannot be obtained with them. Widely divergent ages can be measured on a sample from the same spot. Now here we have the truth. You're not usually told about it, but the geologists all know it. If you take a piece of rock, even a piece of volcanic rock, which dating's supposed to work on, and you take a sample from here, sample here, sample here, all the same rock, but you just take a bit from various places, you can get ages from, say, one says 2 million years, one says 200 million years, one says 1,000 million years, one says 20,000 million years. Then the geologist comes along and he looks and he says, well, 20,000 million years, the Earth isn't as old as that, so we put that one aside. 2 million years, no, we know this rock's older than that, we put that aside. And they say, well, this rock is classified as Triassic. So that's around about 180 to 250 million years. Ah, we've got a date here of 200 million years. This is the one, that's the date. Everything else you push aside and say, here we've got the date we want, that's it. And if you send a piece of material to a radiometric dating laboratory, they will want to know from you, how old is this rock? They won't do the dating unless you tell them how old you think it is. Because they can get any old date from nothing to many millions of years, many thousands of millions of years. And they will choose the one which comes closest to the date you give them. Now, one of the world experts on radiometric dating, Robert V. Gentry, said if isotope ratios are to be used as the basis for geologic dating, that is, if radiometric methods are going to be used, then presently accepted ages may be too high by a factor of 10,000. Thus, ages of the entire stratigraphic column may contain epochs less than 0.01% of the duration of those now accepted and found in the literature. Well, how on earth can we check? Well, there is only one way to check whether the dating method is giving you the right result. You have to date a rock that you know the age of. And since radiometric dating can only give you the age of lava thrown out in a volcano, you have to do it on lava from a volcano that you knew the date when it happened. Well, such a situation is the lava spewed out by the volcano Hualalai on Hawaii, and that was spewed out in, I think, 1901. And that is not. So now we've got something we know the age of. We can compare the dating methods and see how accurate they are. So several different methods, radiometric dating, were used on this. Potassium argon is one of the highly regarded dating methods. And that gave ages which ranged from 60 million to 160 million years. So they looked at all these dates they got, and the lowest one was 60 million. The highest one was 160 million. So, well, none of these are any good because we know this is 100 years. Uranium lead gave ages which ranged up to 3,000 million. So they were no good either. So how reliable is radiometric dating? It's not reliable at all. There's only one thing you can tell from all the ages they took on this. All the ages given by radiometric dating were too high. Far too high. That's the only thing we can be confident of with radiometric dating. Well, when one talks about radiometric dating nowadays, most people, what comes into their mind is radiocarbon dating. And they think radiocarbon dating is very accurate. Now, radiocarbon dating is the most accurate of the radiometric dating methods. It's by far the most accurate. But it's utterly inaccurate. Now, the basic problem with radiocarbon dating was pointed out by the inventor of the method, Professor Willard Libby, in his book Radiocarbon Dating. On page 7, you will find an admission, effectively, that the whole method is bogus, it does not work, and it cannot work. You see, the problem is that carbon-14 is being produced from nitrogen-14 in the atmosphere by cosmic radiation. And we can calculate the rate that this is going on. It's going on at about 4 kilograms a year. Now, the amount of carbon-14 in the atmosphere has been measured, and the rate at which the carbon-14 is breaking down has been measured. Now, it's a fairly simple matter to work out. If you start off with the atmosphere having nothing, and now we start this process going on, there is a gradual climb in the concentration until it reaches equilibrium. And equilibrium is reached at about 30,000 years from the beginning. But Professor Libby points out in his book, we haven't reached equilibrium yet, we're still a long way below it. He said we're 18% below it, but if you look at the real figures, we're still 22% below equilibrium. We haven't even reached there yet. And if you work out the time it takes from zero to 20%, 22% below equilibrium, it means it's only been going on for 10,000 years. Even if there was none in the atmosphere to start with. And the radiocarbon method assumes there has been a constant equilibrium level for at least 40,000 years. And it's not even there yet, so the method cannot work. Well, this he admitted in his book, but the first time the radiocarbon method was introduced was in a journal of science. It's called Science. The top two journals in science are Nature and Science. They are the absolute top. Nature's number one, Science is a close second. And in Science, he introduced his method, and he said the research in the development of the radiocarbon dating method consisted of two stages. One, dating samples from historic and then prehistoric epochs, respectively. That's what they intended to do to see if the method works. But he said, Arnold, that's his co-worker, and I had our first shock when our advisors informed us that history extended back for only 5,000 years. Now, they had gone through school just like you have, and been told about all these vast numbers of years and these ancient civilizations. They'd gone through university and heard about all these vast numbers of years and the ancient civilizations. They'd reached the very top. Now he's a professor. He's a really world top professor. And now he goes along and wants some of this material from these ancient civilizations. And then he finds out history actually only goes back 5,000 years. you read statements to the effect that such and such a society or archaeological site is 20,000 years old. We learned, rather, that these numbers, these ancient ages, are not known accurately. In fact, the earliest historical date that has been established with any degree of certainty is about the time of the first dynasty of Egypt. That's about 2000 BC. So when you're told about these civilizations 20,000, 30,000, 100,000 years ago, it's all speculation, it's all fairy stories. Well, there is no truth to the idea that radiometric dating, any kind of radiometric dating, can give us an accurate age for the Earth. They are all utterly and completely reliable. Well, what other kind of dating methods are there that indicate an age greater than the Bible says? Here we've got a piece of rock which has got layers, alternating layers of fine and dark and fine and coarse material. Does anybody know what these are called? They're called varves. Now, when I started giving lectures, as I'm doing now, nobody had an answer to what the atheists, the geologists, the secular humanists said. They said, aha, here we've got proof of vast numbers of years, because these valves are laid down one per year. What happens is water flows into lakes, particularly lakes near glaciers, and the water comes in the summer when the ice is melting. And it comes in quickly and it carries in the sand and the clay, and the sand quickly settles out. And then later, the clay settles down on top, and so you've got one layer, sand, clay, in one year. And then the next year there's an ice melt, and this brings in the sand and the clay. So every one of these little bands is a year. And there are places in the world where there are millions of these things. So here we've got places that show, without a doubt, millions of years. And I would just have to look at this and say, well, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to this, but I believe the Bible. There will be an answer to this problem, but I don't know it. Well, the answer came a few years later when a French scientist called Guy Berthaud looked into this, and he found nobody has ever measured, nobody has ever observed these things forming one per year. It's just assumed. So he did some experiments. And all he did was he mixed up some fine material and poured it through water, and he found that although it was all mixed up, it settled out into bands using the energy of the material falling from above to move the material below the surface, and it formed bands like this. He ground up varved rock, and then he found the spacing between the dark, fine and the coarse was exactly the same as in the original rock. He could build up hundreds of these in just a few minutes. It did not build up the way we had been told. You can build up vast amounts of valves very quickly. Well, another thing that's put forward for a great age is astronomy. People say, well, even if we haven't got any proof that the Earth really is old, there's lots of proof in astronomy, and we're part of the universe, we're part of the solar system, so if the solar system is thousands of years, millions of years old, then so are we. But there are plenty of things We can observe in astronomy also that suggest time doesn't go back more than a few thousand years. For example, we've got a very famous astronomical object here. Anybody tell me what it is? This is called the Horsehead Nebula. It's in Orion. And just below it, lost in the glow here from the great nebula of Orion, there are four stars called the Trapezium. And measurements have been made on those stars, and they are flying apart so quickly that if you push them back in time, they would all have been touching less than 10,000 years ago. So it's hard to see how those stars can have been there for more than 10,000 years. Then we've got comets. Now this comet is actually called Ikkyosaki. You cannot see the comet here. All you can see is dust blown away from it. The comet is actually a small body down there. It's about 10 kilometers in diameter. And all this is material blown off into space. It's been evaporated by the sun, and it's blown into space by the solar wind. This is millions of kilometers across and many kilometers long. And this is all material evaporated and blown off into space, and it's lost to the comet forever. And this is losing about 10 tons of material every second. Now, it can't carry on losing 10 tons of material every second and last very long. And it's been shown that no comet can last longer than about 10,000 years. But we've still got comets. That means less than 10,000 years. Well, the people who love the millions of years don't like that. So they made a speculation. They said the solar system must be surrounded by a huge cloud of comets, and it's called the Oort cloud, after the man who invented it. And those comets, the Oort cloud, cannot be seen or detected in any way. And there must be a dark star, which also cannot be seen or detected in any way, but it's been given a name, it's been called Nemesis. And this star sometimes comes close enough to disturb some of these comets in their orbit, and some of them go racing in towards the sun, and Jupiter just happens to catch it by its gravity and turn them into short period comets. That's why we've got comets. Well, calculations were done which show that if such a thing were to happen, then the sun would actually slingshot it out into space. Just like the space probes, they go around Jupiter and it acts like a slingshot and throws them out into space. That same thing would happen here. So that doesn't work. So then we came up with an idea called the Kuiper Belt. That's supposed to be a belt outside the orbit of Mars, and that's where comets come from. But then they realized that if there were comets in the Kuiper Belt, they could only apply comets for a few million years, but not thousands of millions of years. So then they said, oh, well, the comets for the Kuiper Belt come from the Oort cloud. And there's not one shred of evidence that it exists at all. Then there is stellar evolution. You've heard of stellar evolution, I'm sure. Gas comes together to form clouds, which contracts to form stars. Stars form when nuclear reactions begin. And those nuclear reactions cause changes in the stars, and over millions and millions of years, the star changes. It becomes a red giant, and then it gets smaller again. Each of these stages takes millions of years. Well, has anybody ever seen this happening over millions of years? Nobody has. It's all speculation. But scientists, astronomers, have done star watching. The biggest star in the sky is Sirius. If you look out this evening, you'll see it. It is the biggest star. It has been observed for years. All the observations until 150 AD show it being a red giant. By 1000 AD, it was as it is now, blue-white. This process didn't take millions of years. It took less than 1000. There's a star called FG Sagittae, which has been observed to change from a blue-white star to a yellow star. It took 36 years. And since then, it turned orange and then red and became a brown dwarf and faded away, all in about 50 years. No one's ever observed it taking millions of years. It has been observed taking place in a few hundred years. And this, even in a few tens of years. And then, what about the sun? It is assumed that the sun has got nuclear reactions inside it which could keep it burning for millions of years. It's observed that the sun is pulsating. Calculations on those pulsations show that conditions inside the sun must be completely different to what the theory said. In particular, they show it can't be hot enough for nuclear reactions. If there are no nuclear reactions, it's been shown it can produce its heat and light by gravitational contraction. But that can only go on for nothing like billions of years. Well, people then tried to prove there really are nuclear reactions going on. If there are, there should be neutrinos. So a neutrino detector was built. It can't detect neutrinos coming from the sun. There have been other neutrino detectors built. Now, some of them can detect some sorts of neutrinos, but not the electron neutrinos that would have to come from nuclear reactions. So there's no proof at all that even nuclear reactions go on in the sun at all. Now, we are told that the astronomers are confident that the sun and stars are old. Let's see what a real top expert. John A. Eddy is one of the world's absolute top experts on the sun. He said, "I suspect that the sun is 4.5 billion years old. However, given some new and unexpected results to the contrary and some time for frantic readjustment, I expect that we could live with Bishop Usher's value for the age of the Earth and the sun. I don't think we have much in the way of observational evidence in astronomy to conflict with that." And when he says he doesn't think they have much, he means he doesn't know of any. There's theories, yes. And he suspects that those theories might be true, but there's no evidence that it's any older than 6,000 years. So, this story we've come across of the millions of years, that is also, as we've seen, very dubious. It all depends on fossils. And you've heard that the dinosaurs died out 75 million years ago. Why do they say that? Because in this age system that they have applied to this theory, this construction, you don't get dinosaurs after this period, and that's supposed to end at 65 million years, so the dinosaurs must have died out 65 million years ago. Well, at the same time, there is a famous fish that's supposed to have become extinct, and that is the coelacanth. And the coelacanth was supposed to have evolved into the first reptile. But a coelacanth was brought in a fishing vessel to Port Elizabeth a few years ago. It's not extinct. It hasn't died out. It disappears from the fossil record in its 65 million geologic years ago, but it's still alive. It means that geological story is all wrong. And there are lots of things. The Tuatara disappears 150 million years ago, still alive. Lingula disappears 500 million years ago on that story. It's still alive. And then what about the dinosaurs? We're all so confident the dinosaurs died out 65 million years ago. Now, when Mary Schweitzer discovered dinosaurs, which are not fossilized, the bones are not fossilized, they still contain blood vessels that are still flexible, they still contain blood vessels, the obvious conclusion was, well, these things didn't die out millions of years ago. They must have died out much more recently. And there is a lot of pottery. This comes from South America. This is decoration on a pot. You see the pot here. And here we've got a man with a knife, and he's fighting with an allosaur. Now, it's hard to see how people could paint men fighting allosaurs if they died out 65 million years ago. Now, here we've got another pot. This is from a collection in Mexico. And you can see on this pot, we've got, looks like, a sauropod dinosaur. We've also got some things we know, like a swan or a goose. Here we've got a fish. Here we've got a stegosaurus. Here we've got, anybody recognize this? Triceratops. These are all on pottery which has been dated around about 1,000 years old. We've got lots of clay figures. It looks as if the kids used to play with toy dinosaurs at one stage, whereas today they play with toy cars. But these are also something like 1,000 years old. And here we've got an interesting one. We've got three figurines here, and one of them is somebody mounted on a triceratops, and he's got a club in his hand. It looks like he's going into battle or something. Now, the triceratops must have been very common. We've got lots and lots of skeletons and lots of pottery and rock paintings and things show a triceratops. And here we've got one with somebody on its back with something there. It's been speculated, well, maybe this is a pipe that he's smoking or this is a weapon that he's wielding. But it's certainly somebody on the back of a triceratops. Now, here we've got the bones of a triceratops in the museum. I'd like you to look at the structure of the head there. Because here we've got a reconstruction of what the artists think the triceratops looked like. And here we have the head of a creature in a temple in Cambodia. This is hundreds of years old. It looks almost identical. Now, in these temples, they worshipped animal spirits. And there are several of the animals, and they include triceratops. Perhaps the most famous of these temples is Angkor Wat. And here we've got what's obviously a stegosaur. Now you can see there is a red line through it. Somebody took this photograph, and at a university they were wanting to show it, and somebody came in and put a red line through it. He said, man and dinosaurs didn't coexist, so I'm destroying the evidence. But there are, of course, plenty of other people who have taken photographs of the figures of Angkor Wat. And here you can see a stegosaur there. And this is only a few hundred years old. Well, that all suggests that the Earth is not that old. And let's get back to look at some of the evidence we've already looked at. I think we've looked at some very, very powerful evidence that indicates an age for the Earth. And one of the most powerful, surely, must be Dodwell's observations of the real tilt of the Earth's axis. It hasn't tilted backwards and forwards for millions of years. It was struck by something. Or at least something drastic happened, some major event that happened, and it's only about 4,500 years ago, and that fits in perfectly with the timing of the biblical flood. Then we have meteorites. They fall upon the earth about 300 every year. If this time scale were true, we would have thousands of millions of them in the fossil record. We have none. We only have meteorites here at the Precambrian-Cambrian boundary, which looks like the Earth's surface before the flood, and here, right up at the top, which is after the flood. All this lot was laid down in the flood. Then we've got DNA. DNA is subject to the laws of science. The fundamental law of science is the second law of thermodynamics, which says everything breaks down and gets worse. That's happening to DNA. It's happening to the DNA of every animal. It's happening to the DNA of humans. It is breaking down, it is getting mutations. It has recently been found that on average, about 300 point mutations with every generation. Now, deterioration like that leads to what is known in genetics as error catastrophe, and error catastrophe is becoming evident today. There are many creatures which the naturalists are very concerned about because they can't find any of the species which are now fertile. They've got so much genetic deterioration, they're not fertile anymore. Among humans, tests done in several places, particularly in Europe, show that infertility in man is increasing at 1.5% every year. You cannot look very far in the future before the whole human race is sterile. You cannot go very far back in the past. You can only go back a few thousand years till you reach perfection. That is what you would expect with the story of the Bible. Now, one final thing I'd like to point out to you. This is South America. There is a lake here called Titicaca, and not far away there is an ancient city called Tiahuanaco. Now, there's an interesting point about this. It is so high in the mountains, most of the year it's in snow. Another interesting thing is, this is seawater. It's 4,000 meters up, but it's seawater. Then not so far away, it's pretty desolate. The only time that anybody comes up here is in the summer when there's a bit of growing season and a few goat herds bring their goats up here. Apart from that, it's desolate. But there's an enormous city, and this used to be a seaport. This used to be a harbour, and there are huge grain stores there. It's obviously in a very fertile area, and there are huge temples. It was obviously a big centre of civilization. It was a seaport next to the sea, very fertile, a huge population. Now, it's way up in the Andes. The archaeologists are confident this was built no more than 4,000 years ago. You can tell just by looking at the condition of it, this is not that old. They say 4,000 years. In 4,000 years, this has risen from sea level to 4,000 meters above sea level. The stories we hear about how long it takes to build mountains is just not true. There is so much evidence that the Bible's timescale is true and the geologist's timetable is nonsense that I can't understand anybody being ashamed to admit that they believe the Bible, not the scientists.